You're listening to highlights from OTBAM, Off the Ball's new daily breakfast show. It's live every weekday morning from 7:45. Watch us on Facebook, YouTube or Twitter, or listen live at offtheball.com.
All right, a special treat for us. I'm delighted to say we've got Brian McClare with us. Brian, a very good morning to you. How are you doing?
I'm in fine fettle. Thank you very much. Yourselves?
Pretty good. I've been admiring over the last few days these amazing photographs that you have of somewhere in the deep, deep snow. I don't know if it's like the current moment of where you are in the world, but certainly on Twitter, you've been tweeting these beautiful whiteout photographs. What was that about?
Oh, it's very kind of you. I mean, I was last weekend, I was in the weekend before last, I was in the Arctic Circle watching a game, a Manchester United game with some Norwegian Manchester United supporters. It was too good an opportunity to turn around because I've always wanted the chance to see the Aurora Borealis. So that's where the pictures came from. It's only light there at the moment. The sun only comes up for a couple of hours. And the rest of the time, it's pitch black.
That sounds pretty amazing. That's obviously like an invite that somebody extended to you. Come and watch football and talk to us about what it was like to be a Man United footballer.
That's absolutely correct, yeah.
That's pretty sweet, right? That must be one of the best parts about being a former Manchester United footballer. Those random emails that drop in your inbox and go, yeah, I think I will go and see the Aurora Borealis.
Yes, yeah, that's what you said. It is random, yeah, but sometimes opportunities come along that you just can't turn down.
We do loads of stuff with Pat Nevin on the show, and I think everybody loves the slightly alternative viewpoints that Pat brings to life, and in particular to his football. And just doing a bit of reading about this, it turns out you guys were kindred spirits all the way back in the 80s.
Yeah, Pat and I go back to 17-year-olds. That's where I first met Pat. Pat came into the room we were sharing for an under-17 international. And I knew he would hit it off right away because he had a copy of the NME under his arm.
Yeah, he's always banging on about his DJ sets. Have you ever actually seen one of them? Is he as good as he says he is?
I think I've always found that if somebody's saying that they're very good at something, there's something lacking in it. You know, I think that's for other people to decide whether they're any good at something or not, you know.
What was that under-17 team
like? I think it's promoting himself then.
Well, I mean, in fairness, we trust him, actually. We trust his judgment so much in football that we give him a free pass and assume that he will be a brilliant DJ. And maybe one of these days we're threatening to get him over to do a DJ set for us.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what that was actually like, because who else would have been on that team? Was that like, was there a bunch of you guys who came through at the same time in Scotland?
Aye, there was. Paul McStay was in that group, Brian Gunn, Neil Cooper, Pat himself, Stevie Clark, David McPherson, a number of players, nearly all of them went on to become professionals, and a number of them went on to become full international players.
And were you at Villa at that point?
Or Gary Black as well.
Were you at Villa or Motherwell at that point?
I was at Motherwell, yeah. Part-time footballer, full-time student.
Right. Again, Pat did the same thing, I think. He stayed in college and I think graduated before he ended up getting his move south. Did you do the full degree? You kind of stayed there the whole way through?
I spent 2 years at university before I got offered a full-time contract with Celtic. One of the things that's, that suits Pat now as well is that Pat went to college. Or polytechnic. I went to university. But where Pat went to at the time is now a university, so he's quite comfortable at his 50-odd years of age, and I was saying that, he went to university.
Eventually, the educational establishment caught up with Pat's brains, I think, is really how he would phrase it.
It may have been the other way around.
How important was that for you then, as like just a human being who had this deeper understanding of life outside of football, before you actually do commit to football full-time?
Well, I think it gives you another interest. It gives you something, plenty of things to do, because there is plenty of free time. Well, up until, of course, you have your children, and then they become the priorities and you spend most of your time with them. But when you're away, they're being able to listen to music, be able to read books and other publications you're interested in. Nowadays, of course, there's so many other situations you can be entertained with the way that technology has improved. Pat and I spent a considerable amount of time in the European Championships in Sweden, playing golf with Nintendo Game Boys at the time. That's how we spent a lot of time while we were in between training and then playing the matches.
When it comes to music and film, what are you watching at that time and what are you listening to, Brian?
At that time?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not sure about what exactly. That's a long time ago. If you're talking about now.
Yeah, go for it.
I would recommend the Three Billboards.
Actually,
outside Ebbing.
Everybody says it's great.
And the most recent album I've bought online would be Alt-J's recent album. But I tend to put the iPod on and I've got going back from the time, 5,000-6,000 songs. So it's just on shuffle and anything could come up.
Yeah, I'm not sure is the new Alt-J work as good as the original stuff, but each to their own, I suppose. In terms of some of the stuff you might have been watching, I was reading an interview from the London Independent done in the mid-90s just this morning, and they surveyed a number of your Manchester United teammates. You were obviously in the survey as well, and they asked you, have you ever cried while watching a film? And I think you were the only person who gave an earnest answer.
Wonderful Life.
It's A Wonderful Life, exactly, yeah. And just the fact that you were the only footballer who gave an earnest answer to that survey kind of says a lot about you, and that you had a deeper personality than some traditional footballers at that time.
I think that it's always been a situation where, not just football, I think with males in general in this and all the male environment, they're not in touch with their feminine side. And I think that's always been something that they've never admitted to, certainly not publicly anyway. We all have emotions and we must have all cried at some point, you know. And it's not a bad thing. I've never felt it was a bad thing to be candid about how you feel or how you may react to certain situations. You know, I think there's a lot of times it's football and footballers try to protect themselves. Maybe it's a machismo thing or not, you know.
Would you have had that attitude when you were a kid playing football coming up, or would you have tried to mask that until you felt secure enough as a grown-up to be able to express that kind of stuff?
No, I've always been the same way. I've always tried to be, I am myself, and I behave like myself. I think far too many people in professional sport have a front that they use to protect themselves. I've seen that on many occasions with players, both in the dressing room and in the public, and other ones who may be a bit more open in the dressing room, but again, very closed in public.
I guess that's a really important attitude for you to have as somebody who's heavily involved with an academy system at Manchester United for so long as you were. Did you find that over that period of time that you were involved that actually people got better at expressing their emotions, that people got better at actually being more human? Or is this just our human condition locks people in, particularly within the elite environment of big-time sport?
Well, I think that there's always going to be a difficult situation when involved in, certainly in football dressing rooms, which can be very tough places to be because sometimes the humour can be particularly strong. I think that what's happened, though, is that the more role models you have who play football, who express themselves in various different ways on the pitch and indeed in the public domain, are going to encourage everybody to be more positive about their own self, and whatever that may be. And yes, I think it has to, because there's so much more options available for players now to be able to do that. I mean, one of the criteria of the Elite Player Performance Plan was that there's a big push for psychology and psychological support, which I think if used in the correct way, can only be of benefit to players as they're going through their careers.
Well, when you think about it, having emotionally intelligent footballers makes them more likely to be able to make good decisions under extreme circumstances of pressure, which ultimately is how life goes wrong for so many people. They make bad decisions in moments of pressure, but you can probably train that muscle. I mean, of course you can train that muscle. You can train that way of thinking, and sport probably has a little distance to travel still when it talks to the younger players about this type of thing.
Yeah, I don't think anybody should be afraid of failing, because sport a lot of time is a big, it's a huge part of it is failing. I always used to think that when I was playing that I missed an awful lot of chances in the, throughout my career, but I had this belief that there was always going to be another one, and perhaps you would score that. I didn't dwell on that. Maybe I trained myself throughout the prolonged period of being able to do that. I think now there's a lot more examples, probably in various different facets of media that people can tap into. And I say there is a lot of other support for them externally and internally in football clubs.
When you were at Motherwell, was it accepted that you were a student and that you were into music and had alternative interests? And was it accepted at Celtic as well? Like by the time you get to Man United, you're a man already, so you can handle whatever that dressing room is going to be like. But on the way coming up, was it straightforward enough because you were who you were?
No, I think so, because it didn't change no matter what age you were. It was the same kind of thing you were. And I went to Aston Villa as a 16-year-old as an apprentice, so one of my tasks eventually was to clean out the first team dressing room. So then they won the old first division at that time, with people like Gordon Cowans and Gary Shaw and Peter With, Tony Morley, and they didn't treat me any differently than they did to each other. So that was it gave me encouragement really, in that they would give you a bit of stick and they would also give you a bit of praise as well. So I learned went into straight from school into a very, I suppose you could describe it as a hostile but exciting environment.
And as Jared here mentioned as well, the university education might help you in that kind of emotional level, but also in terms of your worldview and your political worldview at that point, did you find that you had a different view to a lot of people because maybe you were more worldly, simple as that? Like I'd read something about yourself, and again, Pat Nevin organising a trip to Nicaragua for refugees and to go coffee picking, but that actually didn't materialise in the end.
No, the idea was we would go and take some footballs over. That was the plan. But as I say, it was an idea. Exactly right about. I think you get your morality from where you grow up and your political beliefs, etc. From your parents, I suppose, and their mind have never changed in that view. And it has also, I think, again, part of that is having the courage to stick to that and argue and debate with your teammates, nearly all of them come from the same background, but for one reason or another had decided that they would change their views or realign their views, you know?
That's pretty interesting, because that like holding the line and debating as opposed to just going with the crowd. It's easy to go with the crowd in a team environment. It's the done thing. We're all in the night out. This is how we're going to behave tonight. But to hold the line and go, no, that's not what we're going to do, because that's not who I am.
Well, yeah, there's huge influence over that. But I'd say that I've always think that you should be yourself, and that all the way through that shouldn't be influenced by what you are. So I always wanted to play football and be a professional footballer. But I never wanted anything to do with the lifestyle or the trappings to do with that. My whole idea of playing football would have been, yes, to play for Celtic, Scotland, Manchester United, Motherwell. Part of the dreams of me growing up. But my nirvana, in the sense of what a match day would be like, would be getting the bus to the game, go and play the game, have all the pleasures and the joys of playing football, winning football, and the fans being part of that. And then be able to walk out anonymous and jump on the bus and go home. Now, you kind of have that bit, but I just try to behave that way, you know. So I didn't ever look at myself as any different. I went to the shops, took the kids to school, just to look upon myself, and I still do that. I've been fortunate enough to have several hobbies that have been extraordinary, that's all.
That's really interesting, because a lot of people think that actually the best part about making it is that you, and this is particularly prevalent these days where, like, somebody like Conor McGregor, the whole persona of McGregor is to ditch the original life. It's to get so rich that you become this conspicuous consumer and you burn through money and you have the cars. And a lot of football seems to have taken parts of that. And I'd say McGregor is just the biggest example of that. There's loads of footballers. Aubameyang, we were talking about it this morning, has seven separate sports cars, including a personalised Lamborghini. So that doesn't sound to me like a football culture that you like or recognise.
Must be a long number plate then. No, it is so, because it's always been that. There have always been people who will fall in love with the image of sport. And that's part of the thing, why they're attracted to it, I suppose. I think it's fine having those things. I mean, we used to point out when I was involved with the younger players at Manchester United, I used to tell them about their cars and various other things, because if you will, I'm looking at the car park, whose car is that? Well, maybe Ryan Giggs or Paul Scholes, David Beckham, whatever. I'd say, well, yeah, they can have that car. Why can they have that car? Because they've got the car now because they've won something. They've won several things, and they've proven continually that they're good enough to play for Manchester United and win things. And part of that, when it become a winner and you get into that first team dressing room, you get allowed the opportunity to do that. So even at that period of time, the manager would still pull people up about Sir Alex Ferguson, still people up, well, depending on what they were driving or what they were wearing. A number of, not that many years ago, when they first came out, he wouldn't let the players wear pink boots. Even though they were contracted that particular boot, he said, no, if you want to play, you wear a different colour.
Is there still room for that in football today, Brian, or do you think it's gone to the point now where the players are being paid at such a rate all over the world that you can't possibly hope to be competitive if you want to run a regime that encourages modesty within players?
I think it's a problem, and I think that it depends how you deal with it, isn't it? I think there is. But you need to be confident in your own abilities to be able to do that. Football management is a short tenure, or would appear to be a short tenure, either voluntary or involuntary at the moment. I look at some things and, well, why don't you just say, if you believe in that, say that's where it's going to be. I don't think that you're going to fail if you turn around and say that you don't agree with the players walking in to the ground wearing gigantic headphones. I mean, I think it may be worthwhile saying, yeah, okay, listen to the dressing room. If you think that's going to be motivational, they'll give you that little piece of extra advantage that might win you the game. Talking about them, we used to feel, when we would play the away games, at home games, away games, but away games in particular, where we wore a blazer, a white shirt, Man United tie, trousers, shoes that was expected to be black and polished. And we felt empowered when we got off the bus and we saw the opposition in tracksuits.
That makes sense. You know? Yeah, you were a tribe. You were travelling together literally and metaphorically.
Yeah. Yeah, but we felt that way of how we looked. We thought we looked apart, and that we were going to work. You know, and that was it. It was different from going to training. Training, you could wear whatever you wanted to wear. A lot of the teams that we went to play in a way, we felt like already that we were a step ahead, because they looked as if they were just very much the same as they did every day. But we felt we were on the edge and ready to play and ready to perform.
I think because of the way that the Ferguson era ends, and because of the titles that he wins and the quality of the football and the excitement and the club that he left behind, people probably don't pay as much attention to those early days when life was difficult and he was being criticised, team selections would have been criticised, there would have been, you know, doubts about all sorts of things throughout the team. And I'm interested now, with the benefit of hindsight and the power of everything that comes afterwards, what's your assessment of those years before you finally make the breakthrough?
Well, Alex Ferguson came to rebuild a football club, and that's what he did. The football club had lost its way. And just as one tiny example, when he came, and locally in Manchester, the Greater Manchester, which is quite a substantial geographic area, there were only two scouts. So he recognised, and I mean, I don't know how many I have at Aberdeen, but he had considerably more than two. I think in the Greater Manchester area at that time, there was 5 million people. There's around about 5 million people at the time living in Scotland. So Alex Ferguson had considerably more scouts for Aberdeen, who would have been a very successful team. But he had scouts all over Scotland seeking out young Scottish players. And then him and Archie Knox, after training during the day, were in the gym at the Cliff, coaching the youngsters, evaluating the youngsters, having a look at them, and eventually started again, because I think at the end of the first or the second season, most of the Associated Schoolboys at Manchester United had were released, and the drive was on then to get the best young players in the Manchester area, who at that point were going to Manchester City.
That period of time when the results aren't going the way of the first team, what's your recollection of being in the heat of that?
Well, we were getting criticised after games on a Sunday in the media, Monday in the local paper, after the game, I suppose, in the local radio. The manager was getting it every single day. Now, he never burdened us with that publicly at any time. In fact, I don't remember or recall him really criticising any players publicly in the whole time he's been the manager at Manchester United. So he bore that, the brunt of that every day. Now, we got told candidly exactly where we were at and how poorly we were performing or what he thought, particularly, and he's always done it straight after the game. But we're working hard towards things. We were getting some new players in, and bit by bit you could see that it was improving.
Did you improve as a footballer? Because, like, what? How did your game evolve and change over this period of time as well?
Yeah, I improved because I think that you improve by playing with more and better players, and I think that's the way. And up until the point I had gone to Manchester United, I had just played football, and I was 23 at the time, so 2 years at Motherwell, 4 years at Celtic. There wasn't a great amount of coaching in the sector. I did learn an awful lot from the older players, both in the training field and playing with them in the games. But when I went to United, it's the first time that somebody started to pay more attention, be more critical, very critical of various different things, and encouraging in the way from a coaching point of view. Both Archie Knox and Alex Ferguson were prevalent in that.
In terms of your development then as a player, and in terms of how you had to adapt positionally, how important was the signing of Eric Cantona in that, whether or not you were forced into a sort of positional switch after that signing?
Well, until I was 17, I'd never played as a forward. All my schoolboy and other football had been played as a midfield player, albeit that I'd always loved to score goals. And it was Jock Wallace, who was manager at Motherwell at the time, had thought that I perhaps could become a striker. So I was used to playing in different places. And it wasn't an issue for me. And I always thought that I trusted the manager, because several times I was asked to play in various different places. And I thought, well, if he's trusting to play there, even though, for example, I had one game at Goodison, because he'd fallen out with Andrew Kinchelskis, because I found myself playing on the left-hand side of midfield, outside left. I never played there before, but I thought, well, if he's trusting me to play there, then I'll go and have a go. And I don't think I had a spectacular game. I think I did okay. And that's the sort of... He felt good enough to be able to do it.
Do you have a memory...
So wherever anybody came in, I was just happy to be playing.
Do you have a memory of individual games in that period of time, or is it just this kind of crazy period of happiness where ultimately you build towards this conclusion and you're part of a team that makes history? Is it now, in retrospect, are there kind of key things that you pick out and remember, like sensations and smells and events, or is it just it's a period of my life where, well, we were at it, that was good?
Well, I always remember being in the Colmeal Bath at Anfield after Leeds had won the league, and we found out that Alan Hansen had said that that's the best chance United will ever get. They'll never win the league now. So I remember sitting there in we would be dirty warm water with my teammates, thinking, "Oh, well, we're going to prove them wrong," and can't wait to get the summer out of the way and get back to pre-season training. And the following year, we were successful enough to do that. So that for me was the first time that Alan had inspired Manchester United to victory.
He obviously does it again with his "You'll Win Nothing, Kids" line a little bit later on, but I didn't realise that he'd been central to making sure that that team was bonded. I mean, obviously, they were pretty bonded anyway, and the arrival of Cantona a little bit later helps too. But it's good to have a cause, right?
It is, always, of course it is, because, you know, we had got quite close. It was various, I mean, people go on all the time and say, and it's kind of disrespectful to Leeds, because they won the league. People going about, oh, Man United lost the league. They didn't. Leeds went on to win the league. I mean, you can say we had the difficulty of having to play four matches in a very short period of time, which was crazy, really. But you credit to Leeds, they won the league. And from that huge disappointment for us, I think that it was an incredible, an incredible, well, as I said, we're close, we know they're that close. We felt that we could get ourselves over the line quite soon. And then knowing that we could get ourselves over the line would then allow further success. Now, I didn't dream that the success that Sir Alex Ferguson had would be in like what did transpire, but we knew we were on the cusp of some pretty decent.
When Cantona arrives, is it immediate, the impact that everybody kind of sees in training? Oh, Jesus, this guy's absolutely as good as we thought he was going to be. Or when he, just before, like when that deal is done, is everybody going, what's he bringing this guy in for? Like, look, we're pretty well stocked. No,
well, we knew bits and pieces about the Enfant Terrible, but he was a good player. We'd played against Leeds. He performed well in the games. You could see, you know, he's a physical specimen. He was a good player. And as I say, he seemed to be a particularly, well, a talisman for Leeds. And their championship-winning team, you know, there were several other players involved also. And we were surprised, as I suppose, everyone, that they decided to sell him, and which also, I suppose, appeared to be a very reasonable fee. But from the very beginning, when he first came in the dressing room, he couldn't have met a more humble, generous individual who at the beginning, I suppose, he was, like most people, quite quiet in the dressing room. But on the training field, he showed his willingness to be involved in the team. And we never had any problems at all with any his supposed actions of the past.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those moments in sports history that an entire careers and lives have changed, basically. I mean, it's possible that you guys would have won the league anyway, but that extra little piece.
Well, yeah, it's perhaps that's, but as I say, the part of the Eric was a game changer, and you accept that. I mean, I remember Didier Deschamps being upset that Eric had called him a water carrier. Now, I was quite proud to be a water carrier in the team that Eric was playing in, because, as I say, he was a game changer. You know, he did some incredible things. Having said that, he still needed to have good players around about him who could understand him. And we trained, and we started to get used to his whatever, all the way he played, his passes, his tricks, his kind of sleight of hand with the ball, I suppose.
When the class of 92 burst into the team, was there that also that sense of, oh, these guys are pretty special? Or does it take a couple of years before you actually fully appreciate just how good?
Well, I'd know them all anyway, because I'd been playing for the reserves as well at that moment in time. So I knew what they were all capable of. You know, I was confident. I mean, the gigs had already been in, really, a year or so before. I'd played with Nicky and Paul, David and Gary in the reserves, and you knew they were all good players. It's only when they get a chance to come in and train with the rest of the first team, and then obviously playing the games, that they grow into themselves. I think that it's always been in the time that I was there, and the time that Alex Ferguson was a manager, the first team has been a development team. So young players who have been bought, have developed in his teams and gone on to become some of the best players in the world over that period of time.
Yeah, like Roy Keane, for example, definitely not the finished article when he signs him.
Yeah. Roy played right back for a period. You know, he did very well as a right back, but and then the manager felt it was the right time, he put him into central midfield, where he'd been playing for Nottingham Forest, And then him and Nicky Butt were him and Nicky Butt and Schoolsy were an excellent triangle of a midfield engine and a schema.
Brian, when you leave Man United and retire playing football and then go back, is it a fairly obvious thing to go back? Was it always in your mind that you wanted to go back and be involved with the club when you stopped playing, or was that like a something that Ferguson rings and says, got a job for you here, I think you're an important part of this into the future?
No, I think when I had a period of leisure and I had just finished my UEFA A license when I got a call saying to you, there's a position for you. The manager at that time had said that he was retiring at the end of the following season. Steve McClan, who had been his assistant, had opted to become a manager at Middlesbrough. And I was in the right place at the right time to be offered the reserve team post. And for, to my mind, it was somewhere that I could go for 12 months with people that I could learn a lot of stuff from and be allowed to practice my my coaching.
And I think you stayed like 12 or 14 years.
Yeah, it's not a bad. I look upon the time that he ruined my life twice. He signed me as a player and he took me back as a coach. You know, so 25 years of ruining my life.
Yeah, it's not bad
for me. Yeah,
a front row seat for some of the best stuff that has happened in world football, and to see the club grow the way it has done, really, from the moment you arrive to eventually the moment you leave.
I think it was an amazing adventure, and I'm proud and privileged to have part of that.
Brian, it's been great spending some time in your company. Thanks a million for joining us here.
Thank you very much.
There was one actually thing we wanted to ask you about, because I know you're involved with Red Army Bet as an ambassador for those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, you wanted to talk to us a little bit about the work, the good work that they do.
Yeah, well, I like the idea because people will want to bet when they are going to give or will are giving 50% of their net profit back to the supporters and to supporters' ideas and things that they want to do. There's an awful lot of Manchester United fanatics who are involved in the company. And as I say, are very stimulated by the idea. If people are going to bet, then they're going to win, fantastic. If they're going to lose, then at least their money will be going to their fans rather than to shareholders of the clubs.
And tell me, are you still involved with football on a day-to-day basis? Is that something that you see happening again for you?
No, I'm not involved in day-to-day at the moment. No, I've been, as I say, it's been great to me, football. Still has been good to me, football, in different ways. I mean, the reason why, as I say, early on I went to the Arctic Circle was because of football. But I don't have day-to-day employment in football. But I'm certainly enjoying myself. Yeah, lots of other things to do. And as I say, it gives me opportunities to look at other things also.
Well, listen, best of luck with everything. And again, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a highlights podcast from OTBAM. If you want to watch us live, we're on Facebook, Twitter and YouTube every morning from 7:45 a.m.